This is Christian Knutson and Sarah Hopeful with your local news, coming to you live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison.
Labor leaders are slamming former President Donald Trump on what they call his anti-union agenda in advance of a campaign stop in Waukesha tomorrow. In a press conference this morning, the Biden-Harris campaign and Wisconsin labor leaders outlined their issues with Trump, pointing to his weaker record on job growth, billionaire tax breaks, and making Infrastructure Week a punchline. They also pointed to the Foxconn failure in Mount Pleasant, which Trump touted in 2018 as the, quote, eighth wonder of the world, unquote, and where 13,000 promised manufacturing jobs have so far failed to materialize. Today's press conference included the president of the Building Trades Council of South Central Wisconsin, former U.S. Secretary of Labor Hilda Solis, and a state apprenticeship training coordinator. Trump is slated to speak tomorrow at the Waukesha County Expo Center at 2 p.m. It's his second visit to our battleground state this month, and he's slated to speak to crime, border policy, and the opioid crisis, reports USA Today.
Wisconsin is among two dozen states and four cities seeking to defend new EPA vehicle emission standards. The standard sets stricter emission rules for light and medium-duty vehicles. But these standards are being held up in federal court amid a lawsuit brought by 25 Republican-leaning states. Yesterday, State Attorney General Josh Call, a Democrat, announced he'd signed on to a motion to intervene in this case alongside 23 other states and four cities. If approved, the rule would take effect for the production of cars starting in 2027. It's projected to cut greenhouse gas emissions from light-duty vehicles like passenger cars by half. It's also projected to cut greenhouse gas emissions from medium-duty vehicles like delivery vans by 44%.
Local health officials are again urging you to make sure you're up to date on measles and whooping cough vaccinations. That's after health officials confirmed late last week that a Dane County resident had been diagnosed with measles, which is highly contagious and potentially fatal. Public Health Madison Dane County released information about places people were possibly exposed early last week. At a quick trip in Milton, several hospitals in Janesville, a repair shop in Madison, and a Noodles & Company in Cottage Grove. Meanwhile, Brown County officials are reporting a rising number of cases of whooping cough, which can be fatal for infants, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. You can look up your immunization status using the Wisconsin Immunization Registry online. The tool requires a name and birth date, plus a Social Security number or Medicaid ID or healthcare member ID.
As May approaches, some communities across Wisconsin are getting ready to celebrate No Mow May, an idea to help pollinators in the spring. Over the past few years, more than 20 municipalities in Wisconsin have adopted No Mow May, which suspends ordinances requiring property owners to cut their grass regularly. Participating cities include Green Bay, Oshkosh, La Crosse, and Wausau. For the third year in a row, the city of Madison is doing something a little differently, encouraging residents to practice low mow may instead. City planners say this approach is likely better for pollinators. The rules allow property owners to mow just twice this month instead of every 7 to 10 days. Rather than not mowing in May and firing up the mower in June, the city says a low mow approach gives dandelions, clovers, and other plants a chance to rebloom before lawns are cut back down in June.
After facing strong pushback spurred on by prominent Madisonians, city planners are tweaking a draft plan that will help inform land use on Madison's west side for a decade to come. After a controversial meeting in March over the draft west area plan with standing room only, city planners said they'd pump the brakes on moving forward too quickly. Now they've adjusted one key concern voiced by some west side residents, moving a plan for the bike path from an area greenway onto city streets. It's not the first time city planners have had to alter decisions about the Sauk Creek Greenway, an approximately mile-long waterway that directs stormwater into nearby Wexford Pond that is ardently defended by some neighbors. City planners tell the Wisconsin State Journal that this is one of several tweaks to come and that there will be an additional public input session in May and early June before the draft plan heads to the City Council. Those were the headlines, and now on to the rest of today's top stories.
Student demonstrators are still camped out on UW-Madison's Library Mall in solidarity with Gaza. They've weathered their first night, but not without incident. WORT News producer Faye Parks has the latest.
Dozens of student demonstrators at UW-Madison are on day two of occupying Library Mall. Abigail Smith, a coordinator with Young Democratic Socialists of America's UW chapter, says demonstrators like her were well supplied on their first night.
The only difficulty was the cops. We were well supported by our community. We kept each other safe. We kept watching shifts, and we had a great night.
Smith says law enforcement hung around the encampment through the evening, but didn't engage with them directly.
Every time that they would get close, we would rally, and that seemed to scare them off pretty good. So eventually they just dispersed.
Madison Alder MGR Govindarajan represents the campus area on the Common Council. He was one of three local elected officials who headed to the Fluno Center last night, where police officers were stationed and monitoring the demonstration. He and Alder Juliana Bennett of downtown Madison and Dane County Supervisor Heidi Wegleitner of Madison's Near East Side headed to the Fluno Center to check in with the police. He says he saw a handful of police officers, and one pushed the group from behind.
I don't know which officer physically touched me. I had completely turned around and started leaving at that point. So I was either at the doorframe or a little past the doorframe by the time I had the hand shove me.
In a joint statement yesterday, UW-Madison administration leaders said they would negotiate with students, but only after they stopped camping on university land. That statement was signed by Chancellor Jennifer Mnuchin and four other top-ranking administrators. It goes on to point to state law, which expressly prohibits camping on campus facilities, including, quote, the pitching of tents or the overnight use of sleeping bags, blankets, makeshift shelters, motorhomes, campers, or camp trailers, unquote. But students tell WORT this afternoon they're not leaving until their demands are met. As negotiations stall, Alder Govindarajan says there are guidelines in place tonight.
If the police do come back and take the tents down, I've been told that they will give at least one warning to the demonstrators before they are removed.
Abigail Smith of the school's YDSA says that the majority of demonstrators don't plan to resist should law enforcement move in.
Our understanding is that we are less likely to face charges if we do not resist arrest. Of course, cops decide what is or is not resisting arrest, but we will do our best to not increase charges on people who will already be in a vulnerable position.
Meanwhile, a group of faculty members are also stationed on Library Mall to make sure that students are safe and not at risk of expulsion. Juliana Shimidas is a history professor at UW-Madison and a WORT volunteer. She says that the administration's rule about tents on campus grounds is more flexible than they're letting on, and they can choose to grant exceptions.
So our question as faculty liaisons has been, why can't that right be granted in this case when this encampment is clearly peaceful and not a threat to public safety?
Student demonstrators say they have plenty of food and water, but Smith says there are still ways to support the encampment.
Last night we were chilly, so blankets are great, lights are great, a generator would be really great, ours died. And also SJP is always able to be contacted on Instagram, so is YDSA, and we are happy to talk to people who are willing to bring in supplies. This is all community support, and it's been really amazing to see.
Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
According to a new report, about one-third of adults in the United States are interested in cutting back on eating meat. Their driving motivations are most often health and cost, but plant-rich meals can also help the climate. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz of Yale's Climate Connections has more.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. About a third of U.S. adults say they're interested in reducing the amount of meat they eat, even if they're not planning to become vegetarian or vegan.
Which is a really exciting finding because it's showing that food culture is beginning to bend in a more sustainable direction.
Eve Turrell-Paul is founder and executive director of the Food for Climate League. The nonprofit partnered on a recent report about people's eating habits and attitudes about plant-forward diets.
Plants really are at the forefront of the meal, and meat or other animal products such as dairy, butter, are going to be playing a supporting role to the plants. And by plants, we're not just talking about leafy greens. We're talking about whole grains, nuts, seeds, legumes. It runs the whole gamut.
According to the report, most people considering a more plant-forward diet are motivated by health or cost. But eating less meat also helps the climate. It reduces the deforestation caused by animal agriculture and it helps limit climate warming methane emissions from cows.
We don't need the whole world to be vegan and vegetarian. We do need everyone to be reducing the amount of animal protein that they are consuming.
So she's excited that more people are getting hungry for plant-forward meals. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
According to projections from city staff, Madison is facing a $27 million deficit in next year's budget. Right now, the Common Council is looking for solutions, and alders are seeking feedback from residents. They've scheduled a series of community engagement events, and the first meeting is tomorrow. WORT News producer Faye Parks spoke to Alder Annette Figueroa-Cole, the council's new president, to learn how the city plans to keep Madisonians involved in the budget process.
Thank you for joining me, Alder Figueroa-Cole.
Thank you for having me, Faye.
Absolutely. And first off, I'd like to congratulate you on being the new Common Council president.
Thank you.
And of course, you know, you are coming into the job during a pretty tricky time. So we know that there's a projected $27 million budget shortfall for next year. And from my understanding, the solutions boil down to spending cuts or increased revenue. So what are the primary options the Common Council is considering?
Well, Indeed Finance presented a projection to the council as part of their budget process, and they're working on determining the final dollar amount. We know that past administrations have successfully balanced the budget using the room tax, ambulance fees, and the urban forestry special charge. And past budgets have also included cost allocations, such as moving traffic enforcement under parking. So this budget deficit is a multi-year issue that the pandemic has further complicated. So the council, via a resolution this month, asked the staff to provide a combination of things to help us evaluate which path to move forward. And that includes spending reductions and revenue sources ideas for the 2025 budget. The reductions can include, you know, will include things like cutting service levels, looking for efficiencies. And it is essential to understand the impact of cuts of things like libraries, garbage pickup, police, fire, and what the cut of those services means for the entire city. So for the revenue side, we don't have a lot of options. So we are asking staff to provide us with any ideas on developing a new fee or increasing existing fees, as well as preparing multiple language information for a potential referendum or referendum options.
And can you tell me a little bit more about that referendum? I believe that would be on the ballot in November. And what would it ask voters?
So that is part of the ask from staff based on the community engagement that we've been doing from now until the November vote. We are trying to define what that referendum looked like. I know that the finance came up with a dollar amount, but we are trying to refine what that actually means. A referendum that asks for an increase of the levies and some cuts, or a referendum with the levy cuts and fees. So at this point, it's a little bit too early to define what that wording will be. And that is the main purpose of these community engagements, to help us navigate that information.
And so just to clarify, this would be the property tax levy. It might raise property taxes for folks.
The property tax levy, that is correct.
So you've touched on these community meetings, and I understand this is a good way for all of us to learn more about the city's budget moving forward. So when are those meetings, and what exactly can we learn there?
First of all, if people want to learn more about all the meetings across the city, they can visit the City of Madison website at cityofmadison.com. They can navigate to the department's menu and select City Council, and that when they land on that page, they will have the list of all the budget engagement meetings that we have across the city. So the first event is tomorrow, May 1st, from 6:30 to 8:30 at John F. Kennedy Elementary School, located at 221 Meadow Lark Drive. So that's tomorrow from 6:30 to 8:30. Additional meetings will be held in other locations across the city. People should expect to come to these meetings to learn about the overall budget process, to gain a better understanding of the structural deficit, to understand the sources of incomes that we currently have, what city services we provide and the cost of the city services, as well as any current fees that we have in the budget. That's kind of the essence of the meetings.
I understand that alders within each district at each meeting will be there hosting, and then there will also be representatives from the finance department. Is that right?
Yes, they will have elders from the closest area to the location will be there to participate. We are collaborating with multiple agencies, including city staff. We'll have other people from the city helping us to keep track of notes, to take information, to get people where they need to be. So it's a collaborative effort between the Common Council office and city staff for sure.
And so I'm curious, will the Common Council use these community engagement events to gauge public opinion on different courses of action?
Absolutely. I mean, we finally have a fully staffed Common Council. These community engagements are, in my opinion, a little bit overdue. Now that we have a full staff helping us be able to prepare these engagements at a larger scale, this is something that I'm looking forward to see this year and for years to come. Having these budget engagements, bringing the budgets to the people where the people are, instead of just having everyone coming downtown, having these budgets coming to the people just creates a better understanding of the budget processes, the deficit, and fosters a deeper understanding of the value of the services that we receive and sometimes we take for granted.
So as I referenced earlier, you're coming into leadership during a pretty difficult time. So, of course, there are the budget challenges, and the Common Council is also fielding a lot of public scrutiny and criticism. There are the allegations of domestic abuse against Alder Miadze of the North Side, and then the public's resistance to the draft West Area Plan. In fact, our news director here, Shally Pittman, attended a recent Plan Commission meeting and heard from West Side residents who said they would not approve a referendum in November if the draft plan goes through as is. Does this concern you? And what do you have to say to anyone who is dissatisfied with the council?
Yeah, I mean, I will say that public scrutiny and criticism are part of this job. We can manage the budget while at the same time we can manage other things like the things that you just described. Our intent here is to educate people on the budget process and the limitations. My main concern is reaching the voices that are often overshadowed, ignored, or unable to participate on these processes. I have only been at this job for 3 years. This will be my fourth budget. This deficit didn't start 3 years ago or with this administration. So we were handled a deficit and a pandemic. The pandemic gave us clarity to the needs across the city, and people are still in recovery mode. That's the priority of this budget. The city growth also plays a role on this dynamic. And we have a very challenging budget with a lot of complexity and elements that impacts us all day to day. But again, at the end of the day, we can manage multiple facets of the happening on the city. I mean, we must be able to multitask. What really matters is that the city budget reflects the residents' values. So what kind of city do we want to live in? What kind of city do we want our children to experience? Those are the questions that we are trying to explore with these budget meetings. Everything else will be handled on their own spaces, but our goal right now is to communicate about the budget.
Before I let you go, is there anything we haven't touched on?
I think I just, again, want to remind people that tomorrow is the first engagement. I understand it's on the east side, but in case you're not able to make it to other engagements, you would be welcome to be there May 1st from 6:30 to 8:30 at John F. Kennedy Elementary School, located at 221 Meadowlark Drive.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Alder Figueroa Cole.
Thank you for having me.
That was Alder Annette Figueroa Cole, the new president of Madison's Common Council. She says that the city budget must reflect residents' values, and Alders will use the upcoming community events to gauge public opinion. She's slated to appear on WORT's Noon Talk Show, A Public Affair, on May 6th, alongside City Finance Director Dave Schminicki. They'll speak more in depth about the city's budget and answer your questions on air.
The time is now 6:33, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm Sarah Hopeful, here with Christian Knutson. Thanks for joining us. During the semester, we feature news coming out of the UW-Madison campus, put together by student journalists at the Daily Cardinal student newspapers. This week on The Cardinal Call, host Oliver Gerhartz takes to the airwaves one last time before he breaks for the summer. He chats with college news editor Noe Goldhaber about the latest news from UW-Madison student governance body, which recently passed a bill reforming its police advisory council following that group's six-month break from meetings.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your weekly dose of UW-Madison campus news from the Daily Cardinal student newspaper. I'm your host, Oliver Gearhurst. UW-Madison's student government body, the Associated Students of Madison, recently unanimously passed legislation to reform the UW-Madison Police Advisory Committee after the committee did not meet for 6 months. Today we're joined by the Daily Cardinal's college news editor, Noe Goldhaber, to discuss her article on the new legislation and friction between ASM, the Associated Students of Madison, and UWPD, the University of Wisconsin Police Department. Noe, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Could you explain the role of the Police Advisory Committee?
Yeah, sure. So it's comprised of like community stakeholders, so students on ASM, administrators, faculty members, people in residence life, that sort of thing. And it meets the last Wednesday, or typically does, meets on the last Wednesday of the month to kind of discuss what's going on with the UWPD, like what initiatives are going on, what they're doing. And it's kind of a form of gaining community oversight and input on decisions UWPD is making on our campus.
Yeah, so what kind of involvement in that committee is expected of ASM and UWPD?
Yeah, I mean, ASM has, I believe, three representatives who they appoint to that board. It's three out of a number of members, so it's not just ASM that's involved in this committee. But I spoke with Landis, who is the ASM former ASM anti-violence chair, and he was a member of this committee along with two other appointees from ASM.
So what is the purpose of the new ASM legislation, reimagining UWPD Advisory Council?
The legislation that Landis introduced and that was passed unanimously raises concerns with the fact that this committee hasn't met in 6 months, that it was privately and quietly canceled in March, and that, you know, amid these huge actions involving UWPD on our campus, including in February, where a UWPD officer shoved a student protester and arrested two, and the sudden resignation of former UWPD Kristen Roman, there's been kind of no oversight of what's going on, no oversight and community feedback in terms of what's going on at UWPD. So it kind of shared concerns related to that fact and identified areas in which student feedback could be a larger part of the police advisory committee.
So you said UWPD Kristen Roman, that's the chief, right?
The former chief. Right now there's an interim chief, Brent Plitch.
Under what circumstances were the recent meetings of the council canceled?
Yeah, so when I asked for comment from UWPD, they said that the primary reasons for cancellations in November, December, and January were holidays. And when you think about like the last Wednesday of the month, that does make sense. You know, like the end of November is Thanksgiving, the end of December is our holiday break. End of January, I'm not sure. So it does add up that holiday breaks kind of interfered with the schedule. And then former chief Kristen Roman kind of led this committee. So assistant to the UWPD chiefs, Rachel Laubeyer, said that in an email on March 13th, she said that meetings would be canceled for the foreseeable future. And she explained that Roman's quote unquote abrupt resignation was an opportunity for UWPD to face inward and heal the department.
So the legislation passed by ASM was passed without really any input from UWPD, correct?
Yeah.
So in your article, a UWPD spokesman expressed some disappointment with how the legislation was passed. Can you tell me a little bit more about this perspective?
Yeah. So on February 21st, after the shoving incident at the Engineering Career Fair, UWPD leadership met with ASM leadership. And according to UWPD, ASM leadership was to respond in a few weeks, kind of provide updates for future engagement. And that meeting was, in UWPD's eyes, supposed to like start an ongoing line of communication. ASM leaders don't quite remember it that way, but regardless, UWPD Chief Brent Plitch sent an email to some ASM leaders who were at that meeting, not all of them, asking if they would meet again, and that email went unresponded. So I think UWPD was frustrated both that a piece of legislation that directly impacts them and impacts how they function on this campus was passed without communication, regular communication with them, and also, yeah, without their collaboration.
Sort of a situation of a misunderstanding, but it's also layered with a pretty intense lack of communication.
I would say so. I asked Kevin Jacobson, who's now former ASM chair about it, and he said, you know, there wasn't any particular reason why we didn't respond to those emails. It's good to work in collaboration, but it's not something that we always do. And I do think it's important to note that as students here on our campus, the Associated Students of Madison ASM, they're like our form of what's called shared governments. So they're a legislative body that's supposed to represent the student voice to administration. So that's their job, is to respond to administration, to have meetings with them. And they're pretty much the only student body on campus that has a direct ear to people on campus like Chancellor Mnookin.
So moving away from the miscommunication side of things, what are ASM's goals going to be for the Police Advisory Council going forward?
So they want more students on the Police Advisory Council. They want meeting times to be scheduled in a manner that's more accessible. They complained that they were on this like weird online format and they were early in the morning or across campus. And so they felt that the meetings weren't really designed to be accessible to student schedules. They want the anti-violence chair at ASM to be a co-leader of the committee along with the UWPD chief. And I think both the legislation and what Brent Plinch was saying in his email to ASM leaders is that it's really important to get this thing started and get oversight going, because a national search for a new UWPD chief is about to go on.
So is there anything else you think that the listeners ought to know about this?
I would just add that I think that police accountability is really important. You know, it's important that we have community members and students advising and shaping the role of groups on campus as important as UWPD. And this is something that's like always important. It's not just important after UWPD has an instance where they arrest protesters or is looking for a new chief. You know, students really need to be involved in all aspects of UWPD decision making.
All right. Well, no, I think that's just about all I've got to ask you today. So thanks for coming on this week.
Thanks for having me.
In other campus news, the dean of UW-Madison's College of Engineering announced that he will be stepping down from the post. Ian Robertson, who has led the engineering program at the College of Engineering for over 11 years, will remain in the role until a successor is put in place. In campus sports news, Wisconsin Badgers men's basketball player Connor Asigian announced his commitment to the Nebraska Huskers. Asigian, who had an incredible freshman season, saw dwindling playtime in his sophomore season. This was largely attributed to the transferring in of A.J. Storr, a back injury near the season's beginning, and poor defensive play, according to head coach Greg Gard. The 2024-25 men's basketball season has not been released yet, but the Badgers will face off against Connor Asigian and the Cornhuskers sometime during the season. In other campus news, UW-Madison SJP, or Students for Justice in Palestine, started a protest and encampment at Library Mall on campus. Tents remained overnight despite violating a ban on camping on university lands without the chancellor's authorization. SJP's demands include disclosing the UW Foundation's investments, cutting ties with Israeli institutions, and removing cops from campus. Last night, campus leaders indicated that they would not negotiate until tents are gone, but protesters say tents will remain.
This has been The Cardinal Call, created by UW-Madison student journalists. Check out more news and stories at dailycardinal.com.
A group of Wisconsin disabled voters, Disability Rights Wisconsin, and the League of Women Voters recently filed a lawsuit seeking to allow for fully electronic absentee ballots in an effort to make voting more accessible. Alexander Schuer, who writes for the nonprofit news outlet VoteBeat, has been covering this issue and gave Brian Standing the rundown on yesterday's 8 o'clock buzz.
What these groups are asking for is the ability to vote fully electronically, to submit their ballots electronically. Is that a new idea?
It's somewhat new. It's an idea that surged after the pandemic hit. Though, if you think about like what Americans with disabilities are doing, they're frequently doing their jobs using a screen reader, for example, turning text to speech. So what they're asking for is to apply existing tools to voting. They've done that in several other states. I think 13 states currently have fully electronic voting. So Wisconsin wouldn't be the first to do it at all.
And there are some voters, like military overseas voters, that are using that in Wisconsin now, right?
So currently what they're doing is they're receiving a ballot electronically, and then they're returning the physical ballot.
I see. Okay.
So it doesn't go quite as far as what these voters with disabilities want. And of course, this current law does not apply to them.
So are there security issues with, I mean, one of the things we've always heard is that paper ballots are secure. You can track them. You know where they are. They're harder to manipulate, you know, remotely. Are there legitimate concerns about that kind of security or hacking of fully electronic votes?
This was an interesting story to report because there's kind of two buckets of folks I talked to, and it's the election security community and then voters with disabilities, and both maintain kind of the same philosophy that security and accessibility is not a trade-off. You could have both. This was interesting because it's one of those cases where there might be a little bit of a trade-off. So there have been study groups of election professionals and then a separate report from government agencies. And what they found was if you receive a ballot electronically, that's pretty safe. If you mark it electronically, that's somewhat safe. But if you return the ballot electronically, that raises several issues. Like you said, there's no paper ballot. So verifying that ballot is hard. There's the risk that a single person could manipulate many votes. And one concern I heard from the election security community is, you know, the argument is excellent for extending this option in an ideal world. But if, you know, dozens of votes or hundreds of votes are hacked, could that jeopardize the entire election? That's the question they pose. And then the response from voters with disabilities or advocates for them is security is a serious concern. They're not ignoring it, but disenfranchisement is very serious as well.
So is there a happy medium there where people can have the flexibility and the access to be able to vote whatever suits their needs and meet the security needs? What is the lawsuit actually seeking to do?
The lawsuit is seeking electronic return, which is the idea of, electronic everything. So you receive the ballot electronically, fill it out electronically, return it electronically. In some other states, they have what election security experts maintain as a happy medium, which is you receive it electronically, you fill out the ballot electronically, but then you print and return it. That is something that voters with disabilities, some say that's okay, that's a step forward. Others say you're still sacrificing the secrecy of the ballot because you often need help printing the ballot, returning the ballot. That requires a second person quite often. So that's somewhat of that happy medium. That's not what this lawsuit is seeking.
So tell us about some of the individual voters that you spoke with.
Sure. So I spoke with one voter. His name is Don Natsky. He's someone who actually, many of these other voters do not vote in person. There might be virtually impossible or close to that for them to vote in person. Don Natsky is someone who, he's a blind voter in Shorewood. He prefers to vote in person. He found that during the pandemic that was very risky to his health. So he voted absentee, or he tried to vote absentee. His wife is blind. So while Wisconsin law allows you to receive assistance from somebody, she was not someone who could read the ballot or fill it out for him. So he was explaining to me this process of talking to a remote helper using his phone that was pointing the camera at the ballot and trying to receive instructions of how to fill out the ballot. And he said it was just untenable. He didn't end up voting. So that was in April 2020. So he's an example of someone, he sometimes does go to the polls, but voting absentee is difficult. And then I spoke with Stacy Ellingen, who's a 38-year-old Wisconsinite with cerebral palsy, and she cannot move to go to the polls. She needs someone to take her there. Her parents live quite far away. Her caregivers, there's kind of a shoddy schedule because of a caregiver shortage. So she votes always absentee, and she lacks the fine motor skills to fill out a ballot. But, you know, she lives a life where, you know, she's a business owner. She accomplishes many, many other things in life. But voting is, you know, particularly a hard process for her. She just cannot possibly fill out a paper ballot herself, but she could use a lot of these technologies she uses to run a business to, you know, fill out a ballot.
How has she voted to date?
So typically she votes by receiving assistance from, she said she prefers using her parents. They live an hour away, so they're not always available. So she might have used caregivers in the past, but basically she said it's because of the worker shortage, she doesn't want to share her, you know, political views with the few caregivers who do have time. She doesn't want to anger anyone.
Now, in 2011, there was some change to state law that made this even more difficult than it had been in the past. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is kind of interesting. So Wisconsin law technically extended the right to receive ballots electronically and mark them electronically to everybody. Although when I speak with voters with disabilities, they say we never knew of this option. But in 2011, around that time, there was a federal law ensuring that overseas and military voters could vote in this accessible way electronically. Wisconsin, the legislature, this was somewhat of a bipartisan law, changed this law to say only military and overseas voters could receive ballots electronically. So that kind of took an option away from voters with disabilities, but voters with disabilities say they never knew of this option. That law was later challenged in court by so-called road warriors. So they're people who are like working on the road or they may be traveling out of state. That was challenged in federal court, and the claims were different from this lawsuit. But the court, the appeals court, federal appeals court, were not heavily sympathetic to these road warriors. They're saying, you know, if you're driving somewhere, you should have just kept that in mind before you were voting. They didn't really take to the argument that their vote is sacrificed if they can vote absentee electronically. This lawsuit raises different claims and potentially a much more compelling argument.
That was Alexander Schuer of VoteBeat sitting down with Brian Standing. You can listen to the rest of their conversation on WORTFM.org.
This week, a rare type of warbler made its first appearance at the Dane County Humane Society's Wildlife Rehabilitation Center. Jackie Sandberg has more on this edition of Wildlife Weekly.
Welcome to Wildlife Weekly. My name is Jackie Sandberg, and I'm the Wildlife Program Manager for the Dane County Humane Society here in Madison, Wisconsin. Each week, we choose a topic related to wildlife rehabilitation or the environment, and today I get to talk about one of my favorite warbler species, which is the Prothonotary warbler. It's not a species that we've ever admitted to the Wildlife Center until this week, which is something really cool. It's sad, but really cool. I get really excited in my job, especially as a wildlife rehabilitator, when I get to work with species that are rare, threatened, endangered, knowing that hopefully we can help those animals and get them back out into the population. Because if their populations are very low and they're critically endangered especially, then for genetic conservation, it can be so crucial to the single species to have an animal that is a breeding individual go back out to be able to contribute to its species. So the Prothonotary warbler in Wisconsin is actually a species of special concern, although at one point it was considered to be threatened, or it has been on the consideration list. And it's also had its populations throughout the United States dropping about 0.7% every year from 1966 to 2019, at least according to the All About Birds website, which is part of the Cornell University Labs, the program. If you haven't checked it out, allaboutbirds.org is probably one of my favorite websites because you can learn about any species there. So that is according to their website, which of course pools a lot of data from breeding surveys that have been done, the IUCN, Partners in Flight, and Continental Concern Score. There's a lot of really cool websites you can go look at to see how they rank those species, but Prothonotary, at least in Wisconsin, is special concern. We do see them in Dane County. However, they're not actually on our county list from the Wisconsin DNR as Dane County being like a known breeding area. That being said, I do remember back in a few years, you know, when I started birding and got into the field, that we did have a breeding pair, at least at the Lakeshore Nature Preserve. That was a really great spot where they had some Prothonotary warbler boxes that were set up. But as far as I know, at least now, we haven't really seen them return much to that box at all. So it's probably moved on. Now, the bird that was admitted to the Wildlife Center is not from Dane County. It's actually from Greene County, and that is one of the other counties that are on the Wisconsin map for having known breeding Prothonotary warblers. But generally, you want to try to avoid them between the time frames where they are in the state, which is their breeding time of May 15th through August 5th. So the fact that we have this bird in care right now and it's not May 15th really suggests hopefully we can get it out as soon as possible so that it can at least meet that breeding period. And that would be really, really great. So if you do go on the DNR website, dnr.wisconsin or wi.gov, you can look at the different types of information we have on certain species that are a special concern or threatened and endangered. And they actually have a really great way to go to a species guidance document for any of those. And you can actually open those documents and see exactly
what Wisconsin's plans are for trying to help this species thrive in the state. And so I really like that because it gives a lot of really in-depth information about each species, from the biological and morphological measurements to similar species, ones they're associated with, where they're distributed throughout the state, and everything on top of that, which is really cool. So my favorite thing about the Prothonotary warbler is that they are gorgeous warblers. They are all yellow, bright yellow on the head, with a dark eye without any sort of eye ring. So they look like kind of button eyes. It's so gorgeous. And then that yellow head moves into like a darker green kind of area around the shoulders, and then to kind of a slate gray to blue wing. And it has black legs, a black beak, and then the tail has mostly gray to black. You can kind of see a little bit of shades of white in there, but they are just so pretty. And they're relatively big compared to some of our other warblers. The one that was admitted to the Wildlife Center was in decent body condition, but weighed about 13 grams. That's very, very small in general, but big for a warbler. So we have Prothonotary warblers in the state that are primarily eating insects. They love to hop around, especially closer to kind of sometimes the ground, but heavy vegetation areas. And they do prefer caterpillars, but also butterflies and moths and flies. And they'll also eat beetles and spiders. So that's pretty neat. Occasionally they'll eat some seeds and fruits, but that's more going to be during the non-breeding season. And when they're non-breeding, they are actually overwintering by flying all the way down through Central Mexico and into South America. And I think that is pretty neat. So they do migrate, obviously, each year. And generally, they're going to like areas that are going to be near water. So floodplain forests are kind of the primary type of habitat they need for breeding. And they're going to be cavity nesters. So that's why people have made a lot of very specific Prothonotary warbler nest boxes, which are very small and just fit a hole opening that is specific for them. So definitely check that out if you have an area that you live in or your property, especially around the southern Wisconsin to western Wisconsin or central Wisconsin areas. Think about maybe putting up a Prothonotary box in your backyard just to see what happens. It could take years and years for that to be established, but if you're in a floodplain area where there's a lot of nice dense vegetation and some good bugs, it might be worth putting one up. So you can definitely check out on, if you just kind of Google Prothonotary warbler box designs, you can find a whole lot of them. So really it's habitat that their loss of the areas that they really need for breeding has caused their population decline in general, mostly from logging and taking out a lot of other kind of dense vegetation areas, but also reed canary grass is actually a kind of a problem. It impedes tree regeneration. And so unfortunately that kind of creates an unsuitable habitat for Prothonotary warblers. So not so great there. Also brown-headed cowbirds, which are a species that we consider, you know, native here in the United States, they also will sometimes nest parasitize on Prothonotary warblers and add an extra egg into their box and then can cause higher nestling mortality. So just a couple of reasons as to why we don't see as many of them, but definitely great to look more up if you're interested in seeing more about this species. I really highly recommend checking out both those websites that I mentioned, the DNR and the Cornell All About Birds. So we have this beautiful bird in, Window Strike, has some internal trauma, but we are very hopeful that we'll be able to rehabilitate this bird and hopefully get him back out for the breeding season. And today's segment here is just appreciating all of the diversity of species that we have, including the Prothonotary warbler. So thanks for listening here today. We've been talking about Prothonotary warblers in Wisconsin and the fact that we admitted our first one here to Dane County Humane Society's Wildlife Center. If you need any help with an animal, give us a call at 608-287-3235. Otherwise, go to our website at www.giveshelter.org. So thanks for listening here on WORT. This has been Wildlife Weekly.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's Live Local News at 6. Special thanks to feature contributors Jackie Sandberg, Oliver Gerhars, Brian Standing of WORT's 8 o'clock Buzz, and Dr. Anthony Leisowitz of Yale's Climate Connections.
Super Dave Lawrenson engineered the show.
Faye Parks produced this newscast.
And Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT and wrote tonight's headlines. I'm your host, Sarah Hopeful. Stay up to date with the WORT local news podcast and wherever you keep up with podcasts.
And I'm your host, Christian Knutson. Up next is Spanish language news within the Lake Shore Patio. Good night.